comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you're here, and I think you're going to be delighted as well. We got a great program lined up, great guests lined up for this evening, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. If it's your first time to join us, a special welcome. We're delighted that you're here, and I hope you make a habit out of it. Bob Brady, our producer, is undergoing some medical stuff right now. He's they think it's probably a gallbladder situation, and but anyway, he had to go for tests today, and he was whatever they did, they had to use anesthesia. It put him to sleep. He's not with us this evening, and therefore this next thing I have to do all on my own. In fact, all of it this evening, all on my own. But this next thing is the drawing that we were supposed to do last night and couldn't do because I ran out of ink in the printer, and I couldn't print out all these little pieces of paper with the names of our members. But this is the drawing for the promotion being done by Jerry Wills and Expeditions TV. And here we go. Just so you can see, we've got all these pieces of paper here. Let me make sure we get this one back in. Each one of these little slips of paper, each one of these, has someone's name and their email address on it. And these are people who are members in our members area. And I'll make sure I didn't drop any more. Yeah, I dropped one. There we go. Want to make sure we get everybody in here. And I won't look. We'll just draw one out at random here and see who did we get. All right. This is James Panzerino. James Panzerino. You are the winner, so let's see. Oh, I was supposed to do this. Let's make it dramatic now. You ready? And the winner is James Panzerino. And then we're supposed to do this. Okay, so James Panzerino, we will forward your name and your email address over to Expeditions TV. Jerry Wills will be in touch with you. You can arrange with him where you want him to send what you have won. Okay, congratulations. I think just about everyone knows who Richard Hoagland is. Richard Hoagland has been rocking boats in the scientific world, and specifically over at NASA, for a number of decades. And each time they take a swat at him, it turns out, doggone it, he was right. You may recall that he and the folks over at EnterpriseMission.com discovered in some NASA photographs of the moon what looks like a robot head. Really? Now, most of you are familiar with that. You've read all about it. You've heard all about it. He's going to be with us to talk with us tonight about some new information regarding the head on the moon. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Richard Hoagland, and he really needs no introduction because everyone on this planet that has any interest at all in anything having to do with space exploration, having to do with anomalies on Mars, anomalies on the Moon, and not just the anomalous stuff, but even some things that NASA tried to deny for a long time and then finally came around and said, well, you know what? Looks like he's right. Like, you know, liquid water on Europa, an ocean on Europa, that sort of thing. Anyway, needs no real explanation, and he needs no real introduction. We're just delighted to have him back with us. Richard, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Good evening, Kevin. If you could raise your volume a little bit so I could hear you, be...
It's maxed out.
Okay.
Yep, it's maxed out. Okay, now, Richard, you kind of shook the world up whenever you wrote about the robot head that was found on the Moon. Of course, you're kind of accustomed to shaking the world up, but... and I think that's a good thing. I say that as a compliment. But, you know, you kind of rocked the boat in a big way with that robot head that was on the Moon. And I understand there have been some additional information has been developed. But before we get into all of that, the additional information, take us back to the discovery of this robot head. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's kind of ironic that we're doing this show tonight. Actually, it's not ironic. We planned it. Tonight is the official release of the new edition, the new revised and expanded edition of my book with Mike Barra, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, where we publish the story and the photographs of, you know, C-3PO on the Moon, Data's head, whatever you want to call it. And what we have in the new edition, which has 50 additional pages of really solid information, as well as some mind-blowing additional photographs, is try to provide context for what we have been discovering all these years, looking at all these solar system locations for the putative ancient technologies and engineering and other aspects of science that we have been saying now are all around us and that NASA has just not gotten around to telling us about. In other words, the real history of NASA, the real history of what's out there, has been methodically and in some cases ruthlessly suppressed.
All right, now why? Why would NASA do that?
You leap to the big question. Why not? I mean, really, Kevin, stop. Just stop for a second. Who in their right mind ever imagined that any of the good stuff would be shared with all mankind? Since when in history, except for this unique shining moment called the United States of America, have rulers ever shared anything with their people except pain and suffering and privation?
Well, you're right about that.
The creation of this country, of this nation, this priceless experiment, was founded on the absolutely unthinkable idea a couple 300 years ago that ordinary people have rights, that ordinary people should govern themselves, that ordinary people are not ordinary, that they're in fact the most extraordinary. I mean, it was then and it is now an unbelievable set of radical paradigm-shifting assumptions about the basic human condition. Along with that came this Jeffersonian idea that you cannot be a responsible citizen voting, selecting your leadership, determining the fate of the nation, if you don't have access to adequate information. So the idea, which is implicit in the assumption tonight, that if NASA found really cool stuff out there, it would tell us, is based on the foundations of the creation of the United States of America and its Constitution. And when we look around at the world now, not even the world, just the country, the state of the country, when we have seen the Constitution abrogated in every possible dimension, why would anybody in their right mind think that these tin-order delusions of godhood, to quote a line from Star Trek, would ever share with us what's really out there in the solar system and the paradigm-changing physics and technologies and reality that that would usher into human civilization?
Well, you make a good point. Yeah, you make a good point.
I'm years looking at this and doing a tremendous amount of research and writing a couple of bestsellers, is of course they never intended to tell us. And unless we force them to, they will never tell us. Because this knowledge, in the old cliche, knowledge is power, this knowledge of what's really out there and who we really are and who we are heirs to is the most important knowledge in the history of the human race, and they're not about to let us, the great unwashed, have access to it.
Oh, you make a good point. I can't argue with it. And I won't try.
History.
Yeah.
Kevin, when in history have ordinary people ever gotten a fair shake on anything? Ever. Except in the creation of this incredible experiment, which is about to run off the cliff.
Well, I can't argue with that either. I hope it doesn't happen, but it appears that it's imminent.
Remember, it's not about hoping. It's about the citizens of the United States. When the Founding Fathers put this system together, they were betting that there are more of us who know more about how life and reality works and can keep the tin-plated illusions in their closets than there are of those type people. And remember, it's Edmund Burke who kept saying the only time evil really wins is when most people simply don't get involved. We need more people involved at every level, including a level where most people think it's completely irrelevant to their lives, i.e., the space program.
But it is relevant. I think you would say it's relevant as well.
Set of policy decisions that Obama's going to make in the next 4 or 8 years have to do with space and NASA and how to fund a real entitlement of human beings on this planet to have access to what's really been going on out there, how we're related to it, how we are heirs to it, how its use could change radically for the better a whole lot of problems on this planet, and how that's not going to happen unless a lot of us rise up and take back, you know, our solar system.
All right. Well, let's go back to the head. And you guys were doing some study and some research looking for technology, the remnants of ancient technology that is scattered around the solar system.
Well, you've heard the concept data mining, right?
Yeah.
Well, what we've been doing is data mining the NASA archives, the former Soviet archives, the European Space Agency archives, anybody who's got a space program. We have been looking at every image that we could get our hands on to see if there was a pattern, if in fact there is data that's been published, just not talked about, that supports this model, that there was an ancient, incredibly technological civilization that existed in the solar system before we came on the scene. And from all those sources I just mentioned, particularly now that the web has kind of taken over and a lot of things can be put online where you can access them without going through a person, we are finding overwhelming evidence that, in fact, our model is correct, that there are tons of photographs on NASA websites, on ESA websites, heck, even on the old Russian space program websites, that show clear evidence of ancient technological things, objects, structures, buildings, in ruins now, in incredible ruins, because they're so old and so battered by meteorite bombardment. But they're there, on the data. And what's missing is what everybody's expecting, because that's how they judge reality. They only judge reality when some authority figure sits down and says in the camera, this is the way it is. Well, that's not how this disclosure has been happening. What's been happening is a lot of whistleblowers have been quietly publishing amazing imagery, and it's continuing right up to the present time, right tonight. There are websites leaking astonishing images from the moon, the new unmanned moon program, which is in orbit around the moon tonight, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and its companion mission called LaCrosse, up to and including some amazing things we've been working on for the last couple of weeks that have come in from the ongoing Cassini mission at Saturn. There are some mind-boggling things that we have found in this Cassini data at Saturn, which we're working on now to publish, which I'm going to be going to England in about 2 weeks to present at a conference there in Liverpool in mid-September. And I will be publishing on the web before we appear at the conference a full paper on where these artifacts are, what they look like, close-up photographs. There are astonishing things now that are leaking out of NASA in all directions.
There's also, Richard, there's a big mystery right now, and or at least to me, it appears to be a big mystery, and it's one that looks like a repeat. It doesn't. This is not something new. The Indian Space Agency had a satellite around the moon for the past 312 days. It was taking high-resolution 3D images of the surface of the moon. All of a sudden, they didn't just lose communications with it. It just vanished off of their radar. Kind of like the Mars Global Surveyor did. Just wasn't there anymore. And the interesting thing to me was both the timing and its target. Because the Indian satellite was imaging primarily the polar regions that stay in dark shadows all the time, which is the target for the new NASA mission where they're going to impact the moon in one of those areas.
In October, yes.
Mm-hmm. And it may all just be coincidence, but I don't know, when I walk into a house and I can smell cabbage cooking, I don't have to go to the kitchen and look in the pot to know it's cabbage.
Well, you know what's interesting is how there is this new space race to go to the moon by a whole bunch of countries that simply can't feed their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to ask yourself, well, wait a minute, if they can't feed their own nation, if their living standards are so far behind, why are they putting science and technology into something so esoteric and so obviously not practical as unmanned spaceships to the moon of all places? Or is it that they have figured out by some mechanism what the United States found 40 plus years ago when it went to the moon? And are they trying, in essence, to catch up? And is there some kind of, I don't know, low-level warfare going on to where if the unmanned spacecraft get too close to seeing something, then something bad happens to it and the spacecraft disappears? I mean, that's obviously one scenario that you've been entertaining in the back of your mind regarding the Indian mission.
It is one scenario, yeah. Another scenario, though, is that some of this technology that's scattered around the moon may not be just ancient ruins. It may, some of it, still be active, and some of it that may be active may have detected this satellite, interpreted this satellite as an intruder, and attacked it.
Well, now you've moved from science to science fiction.
Well, I'll tell you what I base that on. I base that on some of the remote viewings that have been done of the moon that say that there are some sort of living machines there. Active machines there.
Well, I don't think that's, in this case, the explanation, for a very simple reason. If you actually look at the history of the Chandra or Chandrayaan satellite, satellite, they were having a number of engineering problems before it disappeared off radio communication.
Yeah, but it also disappeared off a radar.
Say again?
It also disappeared off a radar. It just blipped out. It was gone.
No, Kevin, that is not true. We do not have radar of anything orbiting the moon. We can't.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just quoting the news stories.
Well, the news story's wrong.
Okay.
Whoever wrote it didn't know what they're talking about. We do not have, not even NORAD, has a capability with radar to see what's in lunar orbit. The only way you can tell if something is orbiting the moon is if it has a radio transmitter and is sending information back to Earth. If the transmitter stops, the object can still be orbiting the moon for a while, but it's no longer transmitting, and that, of course, seems to be what happened to the Indian satellite. And as I said, there were months prior to this sudden problem where there were increasing engineering problems regarding the Indian mission. Remember, this is the first time the Indians have ever developed a spacecraft to operate autonomously, in many cases, at the lunar distance. And their previous experience base was Earth-orbiting satellites, and there are different thermal properties, there are different radiation levels, there's different day-night cycling to where you're going into the night, you know, every hour, depending upon the height of the orbit of the moon's surface. So I don't think we have to invoke unusual exotic explanations, because although in the beginning I did look seriously at the possibility that there could be some technology there from someone else that was still alive, based now on what I've seen, which is lots and lots and lots of images, and the databases of all the missions which have gone, only one of which has really ended in this technological problem that is insoluble in terms of the Indian mission, I think it's fairly safe to say that it basically just succumbed to the early primitive engineering that the Indians are capable of bringing to lunar exploration, and that their next satellite will last longer because they will have learned something.
Fair enough.
But what is it that they've actually seen?
It's a good question.
That's where things get really intriguing. For instance, many months ago, maybe a year or two ago, when the Japanese mission the size of a Greyhound bus called Cayuga or Selene went into orbit around the moon, I started looking at a particular set of images. It's very hard when you're dealing with glass structures, and the ruins that we found on the moon appear to be made of glass because that's an abundant material, and in a vacuum you can be 20 times stronger than steel. It's very hard to see glass ruins looking down toward the moon because they're basically transparent. Whereas if you're on the surface or in a low orbit and you look horizontal, the horizon, against blank space, it's much easier to see these ruins because they scatter sunlight faintly.
Okay, Richard, I hate to do it. A break is taking over. We have to step away for a couple of minutes. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back. My guest this evening is Richard Hoagland. Richard, when we had to step away for break, you were talking about looking at all of these photographs from the Japanese satellite and the difficulty of seeing glass structures.
In information theory, it's something called signal-to-noise ratio. It's always easier to spot a signal, i.e. structures, buildings, ruins, whatever, against empty space, against black sky, than it is against a landscape. So when you're looking down from orbit on a planet, on, let's say, the moon, it's much easier to see the ruins rising over the horizon far away than it is to see the ruins right under the spacecraft orbit if you have to look straight down. So I started looking at the early Japanese HD television images taken as they're in polar orbit of the horizon, so that you can basically see things like the Earth rising over the horizon, et cetera, in glorious HD resolution and color. And I found, much to my unfortunate non-surprise, that the Japanese had been carefully blocking out the real view of what was really over the horizon. You could just zoom in and see the blockies on the digital photographs. Everybody knows if they look carefully on a digital image, you'll see these blank areas where someone has taken a cloning tool and just removed some information.
Mm-hmm.
It leaves a very blocky appearance if they don't take a lot of time and smooth it and blend it with the background, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on those early Japanese images of the horizon, you have image after image where someone has gone in with a blocking tool and simply taken out everything above the horizon, making it appear to be a nice, dead black, brilliant, stark contrast to the grayness of the lunar surface. But in fact, they were apparently removing offending evidence of the same structures we are seeing on the 40-year-old Apollo imagery, which was not removed because, frankly, Kevin, no one imagined back then, 40 years ago, when Apollo went to the moon, that A, there would ever be access to all the imagery that the astronauts brought back to Earth on film, and B, that we would have digital computers and something called the World Wide Web, where someone inside NASA could scan and post the real pictures for anyone to download anywhere in the world. Now the Japanese and the Chinese and the Indians have gotten a lot smarter. And so digitally, they have not allowed this stuff to come through, but their efforts to keep it suppressed are so ham-handed that you got to say that somebody was doing it in a way that would make any intelligent observing person say, wait a minute, what's being hidden here?
Well, and, you know, I think there was a great deal of hope when the Japanese sent their satellite up. In fact, I know there was a great deal of hope among people that around the world that, you know, it was like, oh boy, we may really get to see some stuff now. And you know, they've done the same thing that NASA does. NASA didn't do it 40 years ago, but NASA does it.
Space agency the world over.
Mm-hmm.
Even during the height of the Cold War, I don't know whether you were watching carefully, but of course I was, we had all kinds of conferences and missions and meetings and discussions and, you know, papers that were co-published by, you know, the scientists of the evil empire of the Soviet Union back during the days when we were prepared to blow them away with thermonuclear weapons. There has been, from the beginning, even Sputnik notwithstanding, only one space program. And the reason we know that is because they do the same things on this ritual calendar that I have talked about for decades and that we have published ample evidence of in Dark Mission. And it doesn't matter which space program we're talking about. The NASA program, the Japanese program, the Chinese program, the Russian program. I mean, some of the most important lunar photographs in the whole Russian program, back when it was the Soviet Union, were taken on July 20th, 1965, by an unmanned Soviet spacecraft called Zond 3.
Yeah, I've seen some of those.
Back to Earth. And they clearly show ruins on the moon, overwhelming evidence of ruins on the moon. Well, July 20th turns out to be one of those key ritual dates to Osiris, actually, in ancient Egypt. And that's why, among other things, that's why NASA landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon that night on July 20th. It's why they delayed the landing of the orbiting of the first Viking unmanned mission to Mars till July 20th of 1976, and it's why the revolutionaries in the German high command tried to kill Hitler on July 20th, 1944. This is an ancient ritual date, and the space programs the world over are using it as part of the ancient ritualistic apprehension of the space program, of what's really out there, who it really belongs to, and they have it in the realm of mythology and ancient history and not modern technological science. That is all a cover.
All right, I want to get back to the...
It's really a cover to keep some of the people employed by these agencies from suspecting what's really going on.
I want to get back in a moment to this head on the moon, but I want to explore just a little bit about what you're talking about now, these ritualistic dates. I've been to your site, and I've read what you've written about it, and I've heard you on other shows and heard what you said about it, but just for clarification... Are these ritual dates being observed because the space program thinks or knows that these so-called gods of ancient mythology, Osiris being one, is not just mythology, but real, and that... That civilization may still be alive, and there's some reason we need to cooperate with those ritual dates?
You know, that's a really important set of questions, and I unfortunately don't have some equally good answers. I mean, look, it's very hard, in fact, it's impossible, for someone that you know, you know, pick someone in your family, pick someone in your, you know, circle of friends who is a devout believer in religion, doesn't matter what religion, just a devout believer in a supernatural context for all of us.
Okay.
It is extraordinarily hard to ferret out what decisions they make that are separate from their worldview, from their religion, from their religious perspectives on reality. I mean, I know that a lot of scientists say over and over again that they keep their science and their religion separate. Well, you really can't. Not if you're a thinking, coherent, integrated human being. If you really believe that God created the world and everything in it, then that has to shape your decision-making in most areas of all areas of your life. What we have been saying, what I've been saying, and what Mike and I said in Dark Mission with a great deal of evidence, is that this is an ancient religion being practiced in secret by people who pretend they're just scientists or just engineers or just policymakers at NASA. In fact, they are doing things that are as observant of these ancient religious precepts as modern believers do when they, you know, go into a Catholic church and dip their fingers into the font of holy water and make the sign of the cross. One is exactly equivalent to the other. Is there a practical benefit? That's in the mind of those who believe.
Okay, you're saying that NASA and these other space programs around the world,
yes,
are practicing this ancient religion.
If we look at the numbers, they are. Now, you might say, well, how in the world can a Japanese scientist or a public policymaker be formulating, you know, decisions in the Japanese space program based on an ancient Egyptian motif? And the answer is that if you go deeply enough into Shinto religion, which is the ancient Japanese religion, you find extraordinary parallels with ancient Egyptian religion. If you go far enough back in time, Kevin, you find it's all the same. So what we're saying as a model is that under the guise of modernism, under the guise of science, under the guise of democracy, the lie is really different at every level. And these people are practicing an ancient religion to ancient gods who, yeah, may or may not come back at any time, or may have been misinterpreted as entities that are really humans in a far distant time, but who have been raised to a godlike status because of what human beings back then, with full access to this science and this technology, could accomplish. And the facts and the proof of that is when you look around the solar system, we see evidence it's not been left alone. It has been tinkered with by an extraordinarily advanced ancient science and engineering. And some new evidence in that direction is going to be laid out by me at this conference in Liverpool in England in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Now, that ties also into this head on the moon.
Ah, my favorite.
All right. Now, let's assume it's not just a rock laying there, and it doesn't. It does not look like a rock laying there.
Any rocks that have red paint on them?
No, it doesn't look like a rock laying there. But let's assume that absolutely for sure it's not a rock. It's a head.
Do you know any rocks, Kevin, that have iris eyes?
No.
Like camera shutters?
Or a nose or cheeks?
Nope.
Yeah. Okay, so somebody obviously.
And by the way, if you look carefully at the publications, I did a scale analysis which shows that the size of this robot head on the moon there in Shorty Crater is about the same size as a human head.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there it is. It's laying on the moon. Obviously, and no pun intended, someone lost a head. Okay.
Yes.
Who? And what is this head? What do we know about this?
Well, again, without the ground truth, without access to all the photographs that the astronauts took, or access to the actual process where they brought this thing home, because they could have easily brought it home. All they had to do was climb down that crater wall, scoop it up and put it in a sampling bag and bring it back in the lunar module, and that thing is sitting in some laboratory, you know, being investigated for the last 40 years by AI scientists who are attempting to wake it up, to turn it on, to get it to communicate, to get it powered up, to get it to talk to rest of us. I mean, can you imagine what something like that would be able to tell us if they actually went through all those steps and did that? Remember, every robotic member of an ancient civilization knows everything that every other robotic member knows.
All right, Richard, we have to step away for a break for just a couple of minutes. We'll be back, folks, on the other side of this break. More with Richard Hoagland right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Richard Hoagland. And Richard, you had just started talking to us about what a robot head would know.
Well, I mean, imagine you and I forget things. If you're a devotee of Star Trek and if you look, you know, at Gene's exploration of the idea of artificial intelligence, particularly Data, you know, Data is Pinocchio. He's a manufactured artifact attempting to become human by observing what it is to be human.
Mm-hmm.
During, you know, Gene's entire, you know, second generation series. Well, the various storylines involving Data are a useful jumping off point to consider what a real robotic species would entail. And one of the most simple things we can think of is that every member of that species would know what every other member did and would know it in perfect detail, including its own history, the history of its, you know, galactic civilization, their interactions with God knows how many other cultures. And they wouldn't just know it in the abstract. They'd know it in terms of imagery. You know, can you imagine if you're sitting in a history class, instead of, you know, reading about, you know, John Kennedy and his administration or the Cuban Missile Crisis or his assassination, suddenly you see vividly in your mind all of the footage of that period in color?
Yeah.
In other words, if we could get this thing to talk, if we could access its memories, there's potentially the entire history of the Milky Way galaxy or beyond contained in those memory banks if they could be decoded. That's the extraordinary implication of what is sitting there on that Apollo 17 photograph at the bottom of Shorty Crater.
All right, now I want to step away from the head for a moment, but this is linked to it. I want to ask you a question that seems like it's coming from left field, but we'll tie it together here in a moment. Richard, do you have any information or any inkling that there may have been secret missions to the moon that we were never told about, not done by NASA, but done by our military with secret launches? You know, they just say it's classified and don't give any other information. But any information at all that there may have been additional moon missions that we didn't know about?
Well, it, you know, it's kind of interesting you bring this up, because one of the reasons I'm going to England in a couple of weeks is because I was asked to give a presentation to substitute for someone else who, you know, at the last minute couldn't make it. And I've decided to talk on the theme of the secret space program, because I have now come to firmly believe that there have been two tracks. There's been a two-track development of space technology in this global civilization that we currently inhabit. There's the primitive stuff that we see various nations, including our own, engaging in, where you basically, you know, use rockets and you build complex instruments or manned spacecraft and put them atop the rockets, and they have very limited capabilities in terms of, you know, orbit changes, when you can land, when you can come back, how much you can take, how long it can stay in orbit, the way you maintain, you know, the benign environment of Earth for human beings in a manned space situation. I think there is a dramatic, almost day and night comparison between the primitive, you know, decades-old technology that we're still using, which we were using at the beginning of the space age, 50-some years ago, and where the real space program or programs of the world, in fact, is tonight. Now, are these government programs that are developed by governments in secret, using advanced, you know, real engineering and real physics and not primitive rocket technology at all? That's a much less certain answer and question, because there is strong evidence that, in fact, there has been a private secret effort growing out of what the Nazis were doing at the end of World War II, which may have led to a completely independent, almost third force kind of secret anti-gravity-based space program, having nothing to do with conventional military or NASA or any other nation's overt space program.
Well, who would be behind that? Who would be behind that?
Well, I basically gave it away. I said it was developed as part of the Nazi effort at the end of World War II. Joseph Farrell, among others, Jim Mars, and a few other researchers have made the excellent case, based on lots of documentation, if you want to read, lots of sourcing, lots of on-the-record evidence, that in fact the Nazis didn't really lose World War II, they just went underground. They continued. They created something called the Nazi International that was being planned by Moorman and others at the end of the war, and we're seeing now interfacing in some very bizarre ways with the normal reality of, let's say, the CNN reality that you can see on the news. We're seeing some crossover between this secret space effort, this secret space program, and conventional history, but in ways that, unless you understood that that was what was behind it, you would never figure out those connections by yourself.
Yeah, when I say who's behind it, I mean, quite obviously, there have to be factories, there have to be mega businesses that are involved in building this stuff, wouldn't they know that that's what they're doing? Wouldn't those businesses know that they are in fact participating in a side rail sort of space program?
Well, when you look at how complex technology is, it doesn't take much imagination to see that you could literally let contracts to a variety of corporations to make this Framis or that sprocket or this whatever. And the people that were making it would never have any idea for its end use. They may think that it's particularly complicated or very expensive to produce or one of a kind, which a lot of space technology is, but until it gets to the integration point, until it gets to where it's all put together in the real spaceships, there would be almost no real means of knowing that what is being produced is not for, you know, some highly advanced fighter or some secret bomber program or any one of God knows how many black budget off the books intelligence operations are going on right now that the Congress has no idea that they're even funding.
Okay, so we've got this
perfect world where secrets of this magnitude can be kept with almost trivial ease, particularly if there is a constant drumbeat. You know, there's nothing here to see, move along. It's all normal.
Okay, so we got this secret space program. Do you have any information that indicates to you that they've ever done additional missions to the moon?
Specifically?
Uh-huh.
No. But I do have intel sources like John Lear's friends, who keep telling him all this garbage about the moon, which, of course, is obviously designed to get any real people not to consider any of that as real. I mean, in a war, the first casualty, it's always said, is truth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way you keep secrets anymore is there's no real way to keep a secret. The only way you keep a secret is by making the secret so outrageous, so outlandish, that most people will not give it credence. In other words, you have to make the unthinkable non-credible.
Mm-hmm.
You can't keep it forever from the light of day. So you must spread a disinformation haze, a blur of all kinds of other partially true and partially false information around the secret that you're trying to keep. And in other words, you can think of it as if you throw enough spaghetti on the wall, something will stick.
Yeah.
Well, that appears to be what's going on. There's so many counter-prevailing stories, certainly in the UFO community, that you could hide several secret space programs behind all that noise, and no one would ever figure it out.
Okay, so then let me ask you to speculate. Based on all of that, do you speculate that there have been secret missions back to the moon?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I think we probably have developed a base. Somebody.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. We'll come back to the moon base when we come back from this break. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Richard Hoagland. And Richard, when we had to step away for break, you just dropped a bombshell on us about that you think probably we have a base there on the moon.
Well, wait. I said a base. I didn't say we. Remember, if this third force, if this non-national third entity, which has resources, money, technology, experts, and 60 years plus of time, has put together a private secret space effort beyond all national space programs, in essence has become a super civilization apart from the current technological civilization of this planet, then it could be their base. And there's one or two places to put it on the moon for the reasons that NASA is looking in October to carry out this experiment to find lunar water in one of the permanently shadowed craters at either pole, north or south pole of the moon. If this previous effort had sighted its secret base on the moon, you would put it where there was water. Because water, under any circumstance, is more valuable than, you know, gold or platinum in that context. Water is life. Water is the ability to maintain a habitable living system in the middle of a very desolate environment.
So, well, this plan that NASA has, to basically bomb the moon, might be sort of upsetting.
This is hyperbole. They're not bombing the moon.
Well, they're hitting it with a impact big enough to make a huge crater.
Not a huge crater.
That's what their reports say.
Kevin, stop believing all the malarkey. Let me tell you the facts.
Okay.
NASA, because it's limited to non-torsion physics engineering, it's got to do it with rockets, and that alone, that's kind of the prescription they're operating under.
Okay.
They have to leverage interesting things they would like to do with very primitive means. So a group of guys at Ames three years ago, after the president announced we were going back to the moon in what the NASA administrator then called Apollo on steroids, President Bush's so-called vision for space exploration, The folks at Ames decided to piggyback a second mission on the first unmanned mission of the president's new return to the moon campaign, which is called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and the piggyback mission was called LaCrosse, or Lunar Crater and Sensing Observation Satellite. I think that's the acronym. And because they didn't have any resources, they had no money, and they had no resources, they had to think outside the box, and they realized that if they took the booster from the rocket that launched them from Cape Canaveral to the moon and basically dropped it off, the kinetic energy of its fall to the surface of the moon could do something rather interesting. When you do the numbers, it turns out that the upper Centaur rocket stage, when it hits the moon, is equivalent to, now get this, about 1 ton of TNT.
Okay.
The kinetic energy of that rocket hitting the moon is equivalent to basically a car bomb in Baghdad. All right?
Okay.
And it will produce a crater among the literally millions of other craters on the moon the same size that is roughly 50 feet in diameter and maybe 10 or 15 feet deep.
Okay.
In other words, all right. Absolutely lost. Now, all the hype and all the weirdness by, for instance, people like Weber has gotten me really intrigued for political reasons. Why is it that NASA's plan to do all this is meeting such bizarre opposition, almost like somebody doesn't want the white world to figure out what the black world has been up to for the last 40 years?
Well, and that was the point of my question. The point of my question is, if there is a base there, and we start, we do this thing where, you know, we slam the moon with this piece of a rocket, it may be rather upsetting to anyone who might have a base there.
And that's, again, the Weber party line. Why?
Because
they're all part of the same party. You understand this is not happening without their approval? Look, if we're dealing with two space programs, one based on anti-gravity and the other based on rockets, who's going to win?
Well, the anti-gravity is going to win.
Of course.
They could
shoot this thing down next Thursday if it was a threat, right?
Okay.
So it's all a con. It's another set of lies. It's another set of endlessly disturbing disinformation that you never can get to the bottom of, which means you have to stand back and look at the bigger picture. Why is it that NASA now is able to do this and has been essentially prohibited, because they've never done this before, when we've been talking about a moon base since before Apollo? That was supposed to be the next logical step, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were going to go to the moon, bring back stuff. Then the next idea is we were going to have a moon base, you know, like the International Space Station, where everybody would kind of come and play and would support economically and do science, and it would be on the moon as opposed to in Earth orbit. And we wound up doing that in Earth orbit because, for some reason, we didn't dare go back to the moon. Now, there are stories out there claiming that aliens warned us off. What about members of the secret space program who can run rings around NASA warned us off and said, no, you're not going to do this, and something has now changed?
Okay, what would have changed, Richard?
Ah, isn't that the crucial question? Why is everybody tonight going back to the moon? And I use that term back in a kind of a ham-handed way, because 99% of them have never been there before.
Right.
We're the only players that have ever gone, right?
Yeah.
And all these nations that, again, are so poor they can't afford to feed their own people are suddenly seeing something incredibly important and valuable about going to the moon.
Well, I've been asking that question for a couple of years. I've been saying, you know, why?
Question. Now, let me give you hopefully a good answer.
Okay.
Is it possible that they have figured out, belatedly, what the United States figured out a long time ago, because we had our own imported German, you know, engineers, that there is stuff on the moon, there's technology, there's science, there's libraries, there's amazing biology, there's the secrets of immortality, there's anything you might imagine, Kevin, right next door to those nations and those industries and those third parties who can assemble the appropriate technology to get there. But there's only one group which has developed the real space technologies, i.e. anti-gravity, and everybody else is forced to do it with rockets, which is primitive, it's dangerous, it's expensive, it's inefficient, but ultimately, if you put enough money into it, it will get the job done, right?
Mm-hmm.
As we proved back during Apollo.
Okay, so what then has changed? The fact that they have...
What's changed is that somebody gave the game away.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody spilled the beans, let the cat out of the bag. Any other convenient cliche you want to bring up tonight? Somebody let out that the United States had been to the moon and, oh my God, found incredible technology and brought it home to back engineer it so it would be in the catbird seat forever and ever. And how did that information leak out to the rest of the world that maybe Apollo brought back more than just moon rocks?
I don't know.
Well, when I had a Russian film crew here in Enterprise in Albuquerque about a year, year and a half ago, after we did our press conference at the National Press Club, we had an awful lot of Russian interest in our work, and they even sent from Moscow a film crew to spend 2 days here at Enterprise filming, interviewing, recording, taking pictures. You know, they downloaded a whole bunch of pictures on memory stick to their laptop computers. The producer, during one of the film segments, looked at me and said kind of quizzically, is it possible that you're responsible for the new space race? And I looked at her and I said, what? And she said, yeah, look at it. You hold a press conference in 1996 where you lay out that there are structures on the moon, where they're located, that they are to be found in official archives of your National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and then roughly 10 years later, everybody's going back to the moon. And I looked at her and I said, my God, you may have something.
Well, you know, and that could be right, because in that press conference, if you're talking about the one that's on DVD, you sent me a copy of it. I watched it again the other night. You also showed Data's head.
No, I'm talking about the one we did in 1996.
Oh, okay. This was not this latest one.
That was a couple years ago, mm-hmm. In 2007.
Well, I'll tell you, the one in 2007 was, it blows me away every time I watch it.
Because we know more.
Yeah, it's amazing. Okay.
You know, the neat part about science, Kevin, is if you do it right, you keep learning new things. And it doesn't matter what the authority structures say or what science says at the academy or what NASA says or what all the propaganda says. The truth is the truth is the truth. And the truth is that the solar system is so much more extraordinary and interesting than we have been allowed to imagine based on filtered data from this, you know, pet space agency which plays at doing it, whereas somebody is out there doing it for real. Now, where all this meets the road is that in October, there's a NASA experiment going to drop this Centaur upper stage on the moon in one of those south polar sunless craters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been all kinds of very strange pushback from some aspects of the UFO community, claiming that by doing this, NASA is going to get aliens mad at us, angry with us, maybe going to take reprisals against us. Is this potentially, Kevin, a setup for an alien false flag scenario?
Oh, wow. Now, see, that's an angle I had not considered. So let me follow this and let me lay out what I think you're saying. So they drop this on the moon, and then we have the false flag invasion as a result of we dropped this on the moon and it angered
exactly.
The aliens. Ah! You have a good plot there for a great movie.
I've been at this a few years.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, let me give you a few more little things.
All right.
If the name of the game is to prevent any of these other nations from getting access to information that there's a secret group that actually, from Earth, humans, you know,
mm-hmm.
Nazis, we'll call them what they are, that have been prowling around the moon and mining this extraordinary ancient science and technology because they think it's theirs, by divine right, you know, they have the bloodlines and we don't. Remember, they're the super race
mm-hmm.
from this ancient super race, and we're not. So it's theirs. That's their validation of their vision of history. If they've done all this, but they want to keep it secret from the rest of the world, when the world is now going to the moon to try to find their own ancient science and technology from the ancient, you know, whoever was there.
Mm-hmm.
How would you hide that you'd have this base in operation for 40-some years?
I can think of a couple of ways, but...
Destroy it.
Well, one way would be make sure that your base looks like a ruin, but eventually if they land there...
It wouldn't pass muster if you land.
Yeah, if they land there, they would discover it's not.
And if you're going to set up... Remember, all these countries are looking to set up their own lunar bases because they want to be there long-term to mine the science and technology that's there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it in sorties. You can't do it in quick visits. To make any real progress in figuring out the complexity of an extraterrestrial civilization that left artifacts all over the moon, you got to live on the moon, Kevin. You got to have laboratories and scientists and bases and people and a community and some kind of structure where you don't have to commute. You basically go down the hall to the lab, and the guys have brought in, excuse me, the latest hall of technology for you to pore over while you were basically sleeping. I have a small dog problem, as you can hear. Hold on one second.
All right. Tell you what, folks, what we're going to do here in just a couple of minutes is open up the telephone lines for you. And so you might want to get your fingers ready to do the dialing. I'll put the telephone numbers up on the screen for those who are watching KSS TV.
The rest of our lives.
All right. So how would you disguise it, Richard?
Well, the one way you'd do it is simply blow it up. Now remember, that's the other thing. The La Crosse mission is actually a very bad mission, if that's the design of this mission, because it's miss errors. Its ability to target and actually drop this thing on a specific spot on the moon is awful. It can't get closer than about a mile to a mile and a half from where they want to put this thing down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, any kind of base that was developed over the last 40 years probably is not bigger than a mile, which means you're not going to do much damage with 1 ton of TNT equivalent by dropping a rocket stage on something that's had 40 years to grow. Think of Camp Century under the ice in Greenland,
mm-hmm.
or any of the, bases that we've set up in the Antarctic. So how would you guarantee that this sucker goes sky high when La Crosse impacts?
Well, I don't know.
It's really simple.
Mm-hmm.
You simply pre-wire it, and you push the button simultaneously.
Hmm. I think it's also interesting. I want to open up the telephone line here in just a couple of minutes for our listeners. But I think it's interesting that you have this panel now that was appointed by the president going through NASA's budget. And the panel, they've said, well, okay, first of all, we can't afford to go back to the moon. Secondly, we think going to Mars is too dangerous. So it looks like they're pushing back from plans to return to the moon with manned missions.
Yeah, it almost looks like the quarantine is in full operation, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Or, all right, there's another possibility here, and the one that I actually favor.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I've been saying on the air and in books for decades that NASA is not being funded properly if it's really the National Space Program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just look at it. You know, we're ready instantly to throw trillions of dollars at the banks, right?
Yeah.
Do you know how much NASA money it gets every year?
$18 billion.
These amazing, almost superhuman feats of engineering.
Yeah, they get $18 billion.
$18 billion. Now that sounds like a lot of money. That is actually 0.4% of every federal dollar. It's not even, it's not even 0.5%.
Mm-hmm.
It's chump change compared to what we spend money on in this culture when we're really serious. I mean, we spend money, in the private sector, we spend more money on pizza every year as Americans than we spend on going to the moon or developing space technology.
It's amazing, isn't it?
What the Augustine Commission is doing is what I would be doing if I, had been elected as opposed to Obama. It's setting the stage for Obama to come to the nation and basically say, look, are we serious or are we not? Are we going to fund a real space program or are we not? But you have to have a commission that lays out the facts so it looks as if you are responding to the situation and it's separate from your own decision-making.
I hope that's the direction it goes.
Hmm?
I hope that's the direction it goes.
Well, I am betting, if my bets on, the dots I've assembled regarding Obama and what's really going on are meaningful, and this will be a very important test.
Mm-hmm.
This will be a crucial test. But I've been watching the build-up to this. I've been watching them basically say, we can't do anything. We can't afford it. So then, of course, Kevin, the decision is going to be placed in front of the country. Do you want to continue to be the United States of America, leader of the free world, the only 800-pound gorilla left on the planet, Or do you want to abrogate that leadership of which space was the shining example? You know, Reagan's shining city on a hill was and is NASA. Do you want to be a president who goes before the country and basically says, well, folks, that's it. We can't afford to do anything. Americans are not going to permit that to happen based on who we think we are. And what they will do if they are called to, which I think Obama's going to do sometime between now and November, after the Augustine Commission submits its report, my bet is that Obama's going to use this as a reason to basically call into question the fact that, yeah, we're giving lip service to supporting NASA and what's out there, and in fact we're not really doing it at the level that we should be doing it. So this is what we can have if this is what we're willing to pay for, and these are the extraordinary results. Now, the wild card in all this is, at one point, if ever, is this new administration going to actually come clean and admit what NASA has found on the moon, on Mars, at Jupiter, at Saturn, etc., etc., etc.? That would be the paradigm shift to end all paradigm shifts, and I don't know whether we're there yet. I think we might be there by 2012. There's indications that the confluence of missions and information coming back to Earth, that we're not alone in the universe and in the solar system, is going to be pretty much overwhelming by 2012. I don't know where we are on the curve in terms of the specific decisions regarding manned spaceflight and NASA that Obama's going to have to make after the Augustine Commission submits this report. But the setup of the report is basically going to be, look, guys, either we get serious or forget the whole thing. And I don't see Americans as quitting.
I certainly hope that's the direction it goes. And, you know, one of the things is, if
otherwise, you can say goodbye to the United States of America. If we don't do this and lead, remember what Kennedy said, you know, we choose to do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard. That which will test the best metal of us all. We have not been tested in any real major sense for decades, Kevin. And if this president and this administration and those behind him intend to really return us to something resembling what we used to be, we cannot shrink from what is on the moon and in the rest of the solar system. And
I agree, but we have to step away for a break. Let me say to the caller that's on hold, if you want to hang on through the break, we'll take you first up when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Quick announcement, just a reminder that James Panzerino has won the drawing tonight. So we'll forward that over to Expeditions TV, and they'll be in touch with you, James. Congratulations. All right, Richard, what I'd like to do is open up the telephone line. We have a caller that's been holding for 16 minutes now, so
oh my gosh.
Let's bring that caller on. And caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello there, Richard. It's great to talk to you again.
Two Kevins and one Richard, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've spoken before, Richard. I spoke to you on Coast to Coast a couple of times, and I also called you on the Kevin Smith Show here before also.
Okay.
Richard, I've always been saying that, you know, one person doesn't have all the answers, but there are some people that have a heck of a lot of them, and I think you are definitely one of those people that have a lot of the answers that people are looking for, especially when NASA and the mainstream media, the ones that are running the show, the people like to call them the Illuminati and whatnot. You know, they like to keep the true information from us. I one one person I also like to say is has been telling it like it is, and I think it has a lot to do with all the structures that have been seen on the moon, Tithonia City on Mars, and one of those guys, and those are the ones like Zechariah Sitchin, Graham Hancock, and the others, who postulate that there were humans that were actually not that actually put not only put us here, but from elsewhere, and they are the ones that built those ancient structures that we see on the moon. What are your thoughts on some of the works of some of these people?
What do I think of their work?
Yeah.
Oh, I think some of it is absolutely exemplary. In fact, I'm hoping I'm going to see Graham when we go to England in a couple of weeks. We had planned to get together, but he has just finished his first novel, which is obviously an exhausting process for someone who normally doesn't write fiction, which Graham didn't, and so he's taking some time off, and I don't know whether our schedules are going to allow us to see each other, but he's obviously someone that I respect mightily in probing into the ancient past of this planet and trying to figure out, you know, where the myth stops and the history begins. Another person would be Dr. Joseph Farrell, mm-hmm. who has been on this show several times. Joseph is doing extraordinary work in the modern era in trying to figure out what were the Nazis up to at the end of the war, and did in fact their experiments continue in carefully protected enclaves because of what Bormann, you know, set up if they were to lose, which of course they did, but did they really? Because they've now had 60 years of a free fire zone where they could pursue any secret projects they wanted with no public, you know, interest or even awareness. And God knows what we're seeing as a result of that technology development, which was just becoming visible in some quarters at the end of the war. They had some experiments and some test engineering models that were mind-blowing. And that all disappeared into the so-called black ops world at the end of World War II. So Joseph is another person. There's, you know, I mean, actually, I'm highly intrigued with what John Lear keeps telling me, not because he's right, but because he keeps telling me what the folks that are telling him are telling him, which is that, you know, there's somebody on the moon that's mining the moon. No, they're not mining the moon. They're mining the technology. The most valuable thing in the solar system is all this ancient, incredible knowledge and technology from our great-great-great-great ancestors, because I think in the model that we're looking at our own stuff. You know, I think that if you give human beings this advanced physics, that we would become, or they would become, literally indistinguishable from so-called gods, because this is a physics of reality, ultimately, which allows everything from transmutation to the actual control of time, control of the aging process. It allows you, among other things, Kevin in the studio, to make all nuclear weapons totally obsolete. I mean...
And that would be a good thing.
Well, it's an excellent thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that means then that if our guys have access to this aspect of this technology, then why are we all worried about, you know, Saddam Hussein's bomb or the, you know, North Korean's bomb or the Iranian bomb, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, we're back to within the lie is different at every level, and there's nothing like not letting a good crisis go to waste to shift geopolitical interests and sentiments and direction in some area that you want versus areas where you don't want. In other words, manipulating history,
mm-hmm.
playing on people's overwhelming fears of all-out nuclear destruction.
All right, let's go back to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Ryan in Washington State.
Hi, Ryan.
Oh, it's tough to get through tonight, Kevin.
Yeah.
Popular show tonight. Hey, Richard, how you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Well, I've been following you for years. I can't believe I get to ask you a question. This is what makes this show so good. Can you tell a story about when you were at a press conference? I know it might take a little bit of time. Maybe you can make it quicker, I guess. But you were at a press conference back years ago, and there might be some possible link between the the moon landing hoax people, the people that say that there's that we never went to the moon, that this that could all be created by right from NASA itself to confuse everybody. Can you go through that story real quick about what you saw at that press conference?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention this because this is the opening to the revised edition of Dark Mission, which, as I said, hits the bookstores today. Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. The first editions actually became a New York Times bestseller. I think we're now into our fifth edition of the original book, and obviously the first edition of the new and revised book. And in that book, there is this story. When I was with CBS, I was with Cronkite, and I was in California back in 69, covering both the moon landing as well as one of NASA's early unmanned Mars missions, which was culminating that same week. So we moved our headquarters from Downey, which is where the North American Rockwell Corporation, which built the Apollo Command and Service modules, had their facilities, and we broadcast and did extensive programming from there. And then we moved up the street to Pasadena so we could continue to cover Apollo 11, as well as the impending Mars flybys of these two little unmanned spacecraft called Mariner 6 and Mariner 7. Well, I walked into the auditorium there at JPL, and it was the usual bedlam and confusion, 1,000 reporters from all over the world trying to get press credentials and trying to, get desks and phones and their seats and everything for the continuation of this incredible Space Week back in 69. And I noticed there was this funny-looking guy who was wearing one of those 1880s cowboy great coats, the big white dusters that drag on the floor.
Uh-huh.
And he was putting a little pamphlet on the chairs of every reporter who would be sitting at the press conferences in the Von Karman Auditorium. And finally, curiosity got the better of me, and I followed him. And the reason I was curious is because he was being squired around, accompanied by the head of JPL Public Affairs. And I was absolutely dumbfounded because when I picked up the little pamphlet, what it basically said was that NASA had just carried out the biggest hoax in history, that the moon landings had been done on a soundstage in Nevada, I believe. And I looked over at the door, and the guy who was putting these little pamphlets on the chairs was now being introduced to the elite members of the National Press Corps, the science editor for the New York Times, the science editor for the Los Angeles Times, for the San Francisco Chronicle, et cetera, by, again, the head of JPL NASA Public Affairs. His name was Frank Bristow. Now, I look back on that, and I realized what was going on. This was the planting, and I described the whole story in Dark Mission. This was the planting back in the summer of landing on the moon of the meme, or the meme, the kind of thought that NASA faked the whole thing, that it never went anywhere near the moon, that it had been done on a soundstage. Why in the world would NASA be officially squiring this guy around to give reporters a little mimeographed sheet claiming this, unless it was in NASA's own interest somewhere down the line to plant the idea that we never went to the moon? And the more
NASA is the origin of the "we hoaxed it" theory.
Yes, from my own firsthand personal experience. Excuse me. I saw NASA shepherding this guy around, creating the illusion, the historical base for the illusion that we never went to the moon. Now, why would NASA do this? What would possibly be in NASA's interest to create a whole rumor that its most astonishing technological achievement had never actually been carried out, but it faked the whole thing?
I don't know. How would that even... How could that figure into being in their interest at all?
Ah, because only a certain portion of people, Kevin, are going to believe. that story, right?
Right.
Kind of like the same number of people that believe that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, he was born in Kenya.
Okay.
There's always a resistant small subset of people that, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, are going to believe a wacky idea.
Okay.
Now, why would you be putting that idea out there back in 1969? Because those are the same people, Kevin, that also might ask embarrassing questions like, well, what did you really find on the moon, NASA? If for those people it's been demonstrated that they never went to the moon,
mm-hmm.
then they never get to ask the question, what did you find? It's the perfect cover. Remember, you can't keep secrets anymore. You have to disinformationalize. You have to surround the truth with a whole bunch of lies, the lie being different at every level. So somewhere amid all the lies, yes, there's a speck of truth here, and there's a little sparkle of truth over there, but, you know, it's going to be damn hard to put it back together once it's been infiltrated with and disinformationalized with all these surrounding made-up stories. So the idea that we never went to the moon began by my own first-hand observations that afternoon on July, I think it was 22nd, 1969, when I was at JPL watching the head of NASA's press office squire this guy around, handing out a pamphlet that said NASA had faked the whole thing on a Nevada soundstage. There's no other way to read that. It was planting an idea for when it would become critical politically to have most people who might ask questions believing in the wrong hoax as opposed to the real conspiracy to keep what's on the moon totally and forever secret.
All right, now this guy that's going around putting this story out and being squired around by the head of JPL public information, did you ever identify who that was?
You know, it's so many years ago. What I'm hoping is, if I talk about this story enough, and in every media, you know, exposure now for the new book, I'm going to do this. Somebody who was there covering Apollo will have saved those mimeograph sheets. Those.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. We'll take more of your phone calls on the other side. Welcome back. My guest this evening, Richard Hoagland. Richard, when we stepped away for break, we were just getting into this, what's the identity of the guy passing out this information at JPL's auditorium. And you said you're hoping somebody will have kept one of those and come forward with it. But did you recognize this guy? Did he look familiar?
No, remember, I was brand new to that scene out there. I had just been flown out as part of, you know, our Apollo coverage, and I didn't know a lot of people. I mean, I was a novitiate in those years. I barely knew, you know, the major news guys, you know, from the American teams, you know, CBS, NBC, ABC, et cetera, et cetera. But he was someone who just looked out of place. He was wearing this outlandish costume, and it was like he was wanting to be noticed. It was like he was drawing attention in a very obvious fashion to himself and to what he was doing. So it would stick. I mean, it was one of those things that was unforgettable. Now, I was telling this story the other night on Coast, and George, you know, knows Jerry Pournelle, who was an old friend of mine, the well-known science fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry sent him an email saying that he remembered the guy. But like everybody else, he long ago tossed the Mimeo sheet, which had this claim that week that NASA had faked the whole thing in Nevada. He tossed it in the wastebasket. So I'm hoping that some reporter from that era, if they see the book or they, you know, talk to someone who listens to this show or they watch television and watch me, you know, in the next few weeks talk about this, they will have saved in their files a copy of that mimeoed sheet, that little broadsheet.
Okay, well, now this brings a couple of questions up. In fact, a whole bunch of questions. But first of all, then, it would seem that way back then, NASA was already working in concert with this separate space program.
Yes, because
and then
the space program at that time was right in our midst. They were the Nazis we brought over as part of Operation Paperclip.
Okay, so then the question would be, where would this separate space program call home? In other words, where is their base of operations?
You know the old joke about the 800-pound gorilla?
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere it wants to. Look, if you've got access to real anti-gravity torsion technology, you don't have to even stay on Earth. You can have a base anywhere in the solar system, more than one. You could be, you know, heck, you could have bases on the moon, on Mars. You could be walking the ice fields of Europa. You could be doing anything in the solar system that we see on Star Trek or Stargate or Stargate Atlantis or Battlestar Galactica, any of these sci-fi shows. The one thing that prevents modern technology from emulating and imitating what you see on television is the propulsion. Everything else is off the shelf. Spacesuits, environments, living quarters, kitchens, food, you know, reading material, broadband internet, you name it. Astronauts have access to everything except a space drive worthy of the name.
All right. Now, we only have a few minutes left, and I got to throw this in and get your thoughts on this, because and it links up with this separate space program. I think it was 2004, the U.S. Air Force published a document. That document was called Transformation Flight Plan. In there, they mention space-based space surveillance system that they wanted to build and have deployed and operational by 2010. Now, this ostensibly is a system that looks out into deep space for the purpose. Now, I'm quoting from Leonard David in his article about this.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that it's for the purpose of looking into deep space for the purpose of tracking and identifying deep space forces for offensive and defensive operations. What's that about? Is that
back when Reagan conceived Star Wars? Remember one of the conversations going on that it was really aimed at aliens?
Mm-hmm.
You know, grays, bad guys who were coming and abducting people out of their beds at night, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
The problem, Kevin, is it's so hard now to separate the world we see on CNN with the, you know, shadowy world of this kind of potential.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no longer any accountability. I mean, if you really have developed, if we have inadvertently stumbled into a two-track human civilization, a group of humans who are living almost a godlike existence based on technologies that don't pollute, that are limitless, endless, that allow infinite recycling of energies, that allow the prolongation of human lifespan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then all the rest of us who are muddling along with what we, you know, basically, you know, see in the New York Times or see on television.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have two civilizations occupying the same solar system, and there's only a distant connection between the one and the other now. Because the one with access to all this incredible physics and technology, it can live anywhere it wants to. Now, the nicest place to live is still here. You know, you can't walk on a beach on Titan. You'll freeze your tootsies off.
Mm-hmm.
You can walk on beaches here, So, I mean, most of the Earth is still not known. There are vast numbers of islands that are not currently monitored. There's rainforests. There's all kinds of areas on the planet where people almost never go. So you could, you know, have, let's say, bases here. But really, with that kind of technology in physics and science, the solar system or beyond is your oyster. So what I see going on is that, you know, those of us that have been kept down on the farm, kept under this glass ceiling, we are trying as best we can with primitive technology that's, you know, hundreds of years old, rockets. We're attempting to gain access to our piece of the kingdom. And it looks as if we're meeting severe opposition to the point where maybe we will be quarantined, and maybe, in fact, Obama will have to come out and say, for some unknown reason, we can't afford it. I mean, mostly people will accept money when nothing else suffices. You know, it wouldn't take much of a public campaign to get people to really think that NASA is completely irrelevant to their daily lives, because most of them think that already. But it's,
yeah, and that's unfortunate.
Say again?
That's unfortunate, too. It is real, but it is unfortunate.
Human nature, because, you know, so many incredible advances from the space effort of the Kennedy years,
mm-hmm.
take for granted. No one is pointing out to most people how their lives would be incredibly poorer if we hadn't expended those monies and those investments on NASA in the early years. We wouldn't have the computing technology, the information transfer technology, the information storage or assimilation technologies.
Or my favorite.
Information is a critical part of real wealth generation.
And my favorite, we wouldn't have the microwave.
That's true.
Yeah, that, you know, I remember when astronauts came from NASA to my high school and brought with them this magical box. It was a microwave, but it was not called that. And they gave a demonstration how, in, you know, just a couple of minutes, they had water boiling, and it was developed for space. Richard, we have reached the end of the show. I wish we had more time, but we don't. I want to thank you for being with us. Ladies and gentlemen, you can click Richard Hoagland's picture on my website. It will then take you to his website. Richard, if you will, stay on the phone with me for just a moment as I close the show. I want to speak with you after the show for just a minute or two. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap for this evening. I wish we had more time, but we don't. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.